The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday Morning Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. I want to get through most of our upfront messages real quickly so we can have more time to talk with our guest today, who will likely be with us on the 60-minute format. So first of all, the toll-free number, if you would like to talk to our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, 866-687-7223. And you can send email to us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And Space Show newsletters, all of the information for the coming week gets updated this weekend. So please do check it out. And real quickly before I introduce our guest, who really does need no introduction, please do remember that there's a listen live menu up at the top left, and this tells you how to listen to all the different formats of the show. And if you need help with anything, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Also remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, listener-supported program, meaning those of you listening to this show, with your support, we are able to keep our program going. As a nonprofit, if you're a federal taxpayer, you do get a tax break for your contribution to the Space Show. And check with your state about state deductions for a 501c3 that may be from another state, because that varies from state to state. And we also do have sponsors. And on the shorter formatted shows like today, I shout out to Northrop Grumman Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, the National Space Society, and Dr. Ben Arroyo with his two great books on developing the moon, lunar resources, and habitats on the moon. Remember, if you buy the books through his banner ad, Amazon contributes a portion of the purchase price back to the Space Show. If you're interested in being a sponsor or a billboard advertiser, please let me know. You do get the banner ads that go across the homepage, which you can change whenever you want. And on longer formatted shows, I read a message from the sponsor, but otherwise I shout out to them. And your support is very, very important for us, and we appreciate that. And our guest today, we're happy to bring back Dr. Joel Sercel, and he's the CTO and CEO of TransAstronautica Corporation, or TransAstra, which is a new space company dedicated to accelerating the process of human exploration and industrialization of cislunar space and near-Earth asteroids. His full bio is up on the Space Show website. I urge you to read it. But he has won more NASA Innovation Advanced Concept Fellowships than any other individual in the last 15 years. And NASA has provided him more than $4 million in public-private partnerships for seed funding for his company, TransAstra, and he's been raising additional funds for their mission. And we want to talk to Joel, and welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
David, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, we're thrilled to talk to you again. Tell us about TransAstra and what you're doing and what you hope to do and some timelines involved, because I know you want to change orbits in space and have a tug, and you have some really great innovative things that you're working on.
Well, thank you so much. So TransAstra is a very exciting new space company. As you indicated, we've we've won more than $4 million of partnership money from NASA. Most of that's nearly $5 million, actually, from the NASA NIAC office and other money from other programs in NASA. But Transastra is also significantly funded by private sector venture capitalists, and then, of course, our commercial contracts and contracts from other agencies. I think one of the things that makes Transastra unique in the space industry is that we are what I call a vision-driven, practical company. So everyone at Transastra believes in the vision of human beings living and working and settling in space in vast numbers. And that the key to the success of the human species as we move forward is harvesting the resources of space, especially the asteroids, and also the resources of the moon. And, you know, we point out that the asteroids represent a resource that vastly outstrips the resources of the Earth. When I say this, sometimes a planetary scientist will say, yeah, but Joel, the asteroids only contain about 4% the mass of the moon. How can that be a powerful resource? Well, the answer is that unlike planetary bodies where you have to go down through a gravity well to get resources and carry it back up, and unlike bodies like the Earth that are geologically differentiated, the resources of the asteroids are right there at the surface at the top of the gravity well, and that makes a huge difference. And in terms of the vision of the company, we'd like to point out that there's enough material in the asteroids of our solar system to build worlds with 1,000 times the carrying capacity of the Earth. Where this number comes from is if you look at building a radiation shield 5 to 7 meters thick, which is what you need to return radiation down to terrestrial levels that humans are adapted for. The asteroids are enough to build that radiation shield 1,000 times the size of the land area of the Earth. And so we can build settlements in space that people can live in very Earth-like environments with 1,000 times the carrying capacity of the Earth. That's enough to support a population of up to maybe 1 trillion people spread throughout the solar system. That's the long-range vision. And what motivates us is showing the world that that long-range vision is not just a vision, but that it can be achieved, and we can make progress on it in the here and now, make money working towards that in the here and now. So that vision motivates us. And then on the basis of that vision, we ask the question, well, if that's going to happen, what technologies and inventions need to be made real so that it's practical? And we've been working on those technologies and inventions, initially with NASA funding and now more recently with private sector funding. And obviously a critical first step there is low-cost access to space. And so kudos to the space launch industry. You know, Elon Musk is a leader there with SpaceX, but, you know, there's lots of other important companies like our friends at Stoke that are building a great launch vehicle. We saw that successful launch from Firefly, Rocket Lab. You know, you could go on and on with ABL. We have wonderful friends at ABL. So we're going to see that while launch costs have started to come down, they're coming down tremendously. There's lots of people working in that field, so it's a field that Transastra is not working in. But once that problem is really solved, then you have to ask, what are the next problems that you have? The next problems are you need to be able to get around inexpensively in space and fast, and you need to be able to see what's around you. Seeing what's around you in space, which is sometimes referred to as space domain awareness, is an increasingly important problem. You know, as recently as just a few years ago, there were only 3,000 satellites in Earth orbit. Now there's 2,000 satellites being launched every 6 months into low Earth orbit. And we're projecting 100,000 satellites to be launched into orbit within the next 8 years. So this is creating a real challenge in terms of making sure that we can do traffic monitoring, understanding where debris is from collisions between space traffic, and keeping track of all this, space domain awareness. And if you're going to get around cost effectively in space, you need to be harvesting the resources in space to make your rocket propellant. No matter how cheap it is to launch up from the surface of the Earth to space, it will always be far more cost effective if you can be harvesting that propellant in space where you need it. And so Transastra is working on the technology to harvest resources from the asteroids and the moon, and first and foremost to make rocket propellant out of that. Very cost effective in-space rocket propulsion system or orbital logistics to carry payloads from where they are in orbit to where they need to go. And space domain awareness sensors to be able to find and track orbital debris and orbit traffic. And what's great about that is that those sensors are also the sensors we need to prospect the asteroids to foment a gold rush to the solar system. So how's that for a beginning, David?
Pretty good. So if I ask you the big $64 question, when, what kind of timeline are you operating under? In your lifetime, my lifetime, what do you think? How does it even get started? It's a big undertaking.
Yeah, so the timeline is making profits now to build a company which has the core capabilities to fulfill that vision. So so the vision is a long-range vision. And so what we did was we identified the vision. We said, what inventions do we need to fulfill that vision? And we've got about six patents that have been issued. We're getting a patent issued about once a month right now, with at least a dozen pending, depending on how you count it, maybe 20 pending. So we're anticipating another dozen patents within the next 8 months. But they're not just patents, they're not just paper ideas. We're reducing these ideas to practice in our laboratories. So, David, since the last time I talked to you, we've built a world-class space technology laboratory and collaboration environment here in Southern California in the Los Angeles area in the town of San Fernando. We call our headquarters the Hive, and we're reducing all these inventions and concepts to practice and building real engineering hardware out of it. And so the timeline is absolutely right now making money in working with both the government and the private sector. And so the strategy is these capabilities that envision the future, they're not just future capabilities. They're today capabilities with real commercial potential now. And so, say, for example, in order to see faint moving objects in space the way that you need to for space domain awareness and the way that you need to prospect the asteroids, you need better telescope technology. So we've invented a technology. So we've been working on this Sutter telescope technology for the past few years under NASA funding. So we call it Sutter because Sutter's Mill was where gold was discovered in California. That led to the California gold rush in the 1840s. That led to the settlement of the American West and the United States is a superpower. And we invented the Sutter telescope system in order to find the very low delta V asteroid. That is delta V for some of your listeners, how we measure how hard it is to get from point A to point B in space. We know from statistical models of asteroid distribution that there are thousands of asteroids that have delta Vs to and from less than delta V to and from the surface of the moon from low Earth orbit. However, given the state of telescope technology and the number of telescopes looking at the sky, humanity has only found less than 20 of those low-delta-D asteroids. It's because we've only found less than 20 of those low-delta-D asteroids that we don't have a gold rush to space. We've calculated, and the NASA reviewers who look carefully at our technologies agree, that the ultimate application of our Sutter technology will be able to find, in its first year of operation, 300 times more asteroids than have been discovered in the entire history of astronomy. And our calculations show that we will be able to find thousands of those low delta V asteroids, and that will foment a gold rush to the solar system. Now, before we have the funding to build the full Sutter Ultra system that will do that, we're actually operating Sutter telescopes that we've built today at two observatories. The Wiener Observatory, which is in Sonoyta, Arizona, about an hour south of Tucson, and the Sierra Remote Observatory in the California Sierra Mountains. And with those telescopes, we're finding dozens of asteroids every night and tracking spacecraft far beyond GEO, out even far beyond the moon. And so so this is a breakthrough technology that we're very excited about. And its commercial revenue from that technology is this quarter now. And what's really exciting is we've been able to prove the technology by demonstrating it at those two observatories. We're starting to operationalize it. We're submitting asteroid tracks, dozens and dozens of asteroid tracks, to the Minor Planet Center, which is the body that keeps track of asteroids. We are working with the Space Force and other aerospace companies to submit the space domain awareness data, that is to say the debris and spacecraft that we're finding, to help people navigate in space. And that's a commercial opportunity today. And we just announced last Tuesday that we have a commercial partnership with Celestron. David, are you familiar with the Celestron company?
Sure. I think almost all our listeners are, too. Absolutely.
Okay. What's really cool is Celestron is the best-known commercial telescope company that makes high-quality telescopes so affordably that middle-class people can afford them and deploy them in their backyard and look at nebula and planetary moons and even find asteroids on their own, not as faint as we can with our tech. But with the Sutter telescope technology and a specific invention that we have that we call optimized match filter tracking, we can actually increase the sensitivity of a commercial off-the-shelf Celestron telescope by a factor of about 100. So a telescope that you can buy at your local camera store for about $5,000 and be as powerful for finding faint moving objects in space as a $500,000 telescope system. And we do this with software and the way we process the images. So we have now announced a joint partnership with Celestron, where TransAstra is building turnkey telescope systems out of commercial off-the-shelf Celestron telescopes that any consumer can buy. But we're building turnkey systems that can turn those into powerful space domain awareness sensors that can be deployed at observatories around the world to find objects as small as a washing machine out beyond the moon. So we think that's very exciting. And we've also announced that we're starting the development of a space-qualified version of the Celestron Raza telescope line. What's really cool about that is if you want a powerful astronomical instrument that's qualified and suitable for the space environment that can be launched on a rocket, survive the ride into space, and then survive the radiation environment, survive the vacuum of space, survive the thermal challenges of space. Today, an instrument like that would typically cost you about $20 million. And we're going to be building those for our own use on our own spacecraft and also selling them to others for a tiny fraction of that cost. I'm not going to say exactly how low a number, but it's a tiny fraction of the cost of today's space-qualified optical systems. And the commercial potential for that is tremendous. So the strategy of the company is we have several commercial lines that we're developing to build the company that we can see and find objects in space so that we can get around in space more cost-effectively and faster, and then that we can process materials in space. And those three fundamental capabilities will allow us to scale the company, to build a large aerospace company with good profit margins in the short term, and then that aerospace company will have the capability, the people, and the facilities to build asteroid mining vehicles and usher in the trillion-dollar asteroid mining industry and enable the human settlement of space.
I have an email from listener Todd is in San Diego, and he says, can you tell us what your technology and your telescope is all about that enables all of this, or is it proprietary and you can't share it?
Well, there are definitely proprietary aspects that I'm not going to share. It's a vast improvement over other technologies of its type. So the type of image processing that we do is referred to colloquially in the scientific community as shift and add methods, or sometimes people refer to it as track before detect. By the way, there are videos on the Transaster website that explain how this works. It's a very visual process, so it's hard to explain verbally without pictures. To understand how it works, you need to understand why it's hard for telescopes to see moving bodies in space. So if you think about the pictures that telescopes bring back of the space environment, and you see these wonderful pictures of nebula and planets and all the detail there, those are typically taken with long exposures. What the telescope does is it stares at a section of the sky. It's an Earth-based telescope. It means it has to move to compensate for the Earth's rotation. And then the stars are fixed. You take a long exposure, and as the exposure goes longer and longer, fainter and fainter objects show up in the exposure. So if you take a short exposure, say, you might not even see that there's a galaxy there or a nebula. But then as you take the longer exposure, all the faint objects and the detail starts to come out over time. The problem is if you're looking for asteroids that move through the field, especially the asteroids that we want to mine to harvest those resources for the betterment of humanity, they move very quickly through the field of view. So as you're taking a long exposure, during that exposure, the asteroids might only spend a fraction of a second or a second with its airy disk projecting onto a pixel. And then it goes to the next pixel, the next pixel, the next pixel. So the faintness of that dark asteroid moving quickly, although you're taking a long exposure, the moving asteroid only has a short exposure on each pixel, so you can't see it. And what we do instead is we guess the tracks, the trajectories, the paths. We guess the angles that the asteroids might be moving. And we take a bunch of short exposures instead of a single long exposure. And then what we do is, based on guessing where an asteroid might be, we add up those, we store those short exposures in memory, and then we use a computer to add up every possible combination of streaks within a certain velocity space. And if there happened to be an asteroid and we guessed successfully, then the signal-to-noise ratio in those adjacent pixels over time will add up, we'll get a strong signal, and we'll know that we found a moving object, and we'll know its brightness and the speed that it moves through space. And so if you add up, say, for example, 100 images this way, it can increase the signal-to-noise ratio by almost a factor of 10. So it's just as though the telescope, it's almost as though the telescope had an area of 100 times larger, which would be like a telescope with a diameter 10 times as much. Now, we've been saying that this would work. We've been simulating it for actually years. Now we know it works. We've demonstrated it routinely in the laboratory or in our observatories every night. Now, that general concept of shift and add is nothing new. It's actually been done by the astronomy community for decades. So, like, we know a postdoc in Hawaii who's been taking archived pictures from large telescopes that are stored in the cloud and processing them with a very powerful computer months and months after the images were taken. The problem is these observations are not timely enough for space domain awareness, and they're also not timely enough for finding the small, fast-moving asteroids that, in order to confirm the sighting and get a good track on the asteroid, you have to go back and revisit it very quickly. So the difference between traditional shift and add methods, sometimes called synthetic tracking, and our optimized match filter tracking is that we can do it with a tiny fraction of the computational requirements. So we can actually do this in real time as we're taking the images. Let's say we take a 5-minute exposure or a 500-second exposure of 100 5-second frames. And then we move on to the next 500-second exposure of 100 5-second frames. We can actually process that real time in 500 seconds. So we can get this data fast enough to verify it later in the night and do reporting within minutes. And that's how fast it has to be for space domain awareness, or finding these fast-moving asteroids. For slow-moving main-belt asteroids, doing it with an inefficient algorithm and processing on a supercomputer on the ground and waiting months is fine. But for the fast-moving targets for asteroid mining and for space domain awareness, it's not good enough. But more importantly, our algorithm is so efficient that with a very modest space-based processor, we can do this processing in space. And that's why we're working with Celestron to space qualify the ROSA telescopes, because we can tie space-based computers that are space qualified right now, not very expensive, you can buy them off the shelf, space qualified focal planes, and we'll be able to do this real time. And by putting those telescopes in space, we can help the Space Force tremendously with their space domain awareness problem. By positioning the telescopes on spacecraft in different orbits at different libration points and so on, we can do things like find spacecraft around the moon when the moon's brightness would block out a terrestrial telescope. So we're very excited about it.
I have another question. This is Paula in Denver, Colorado. And Paula said there has been much talk in recent years about finding very fast-moving interstellar objects. Can you telescope do that, or is that a different technology?
Yeah, so unfortunately, that is a different technology. It's a really interesting problem. One of our one of the technical advisors for the company, Professor Robert Jedeke from the University of Hawaii Institute of Astronomy, who works with us very diligently on our asteroid finding, modeling and simulation of asteroids, and our optical search strategies. He was actually one of the first ones to publish, and I think he published it in Nature, a projection of how many interstellar objects we would see, and he projected that we would see them soon, just before it started to happen. And he was on the team that published in Nature the observations of the one that flew by recently. But those objects typically are not, they don't move in the types of orbits that we would be searching. Because we're searching for things that have near-term commercial potential, like finding lost spacecraft, finding spacecraft that are hazards to navigation, finding debris, and then finding the small nearby asteroids that are ideal for mining.
Another one, Josh, Phoenix, Arizona, and he says, when you're looking for asteroids for mining, are you looking for signatures in the atmosphere? What are you looking for? What are the ingredients you classify as suitable for mining when you see an asteroid? And are all asteroids suitable for mining, or only those with whatever ingredients you're searching for?
That's a wonderful question. In the long term, virtually all asteroids will be suitable for mining. In the short term, only a small fraction of asteroids will be suitable for mining. In the long term, humanity as it moves into space will be like historical Native Americans who, when they hunted buffalo, they used the whole buffalo. And that's going to be really important for the settlers in space and for businesses that are building large megastructures out of asteroids and that sort of thing, which will happen relatively soon. But initially, the most important thing to harvest from asteroids are the volatile chemicals, like H2O, water, methane, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and others that can be used to make rocket propellant in space. And for that, we really need to go after carbonaceous type asteroids. And for the low our statistical models, which, by the way, we've published in the refereed literature. If you look for papers by lead author is Jedeke, second author is Tercel, you will see our statistical model to that. But we're projecting that on the order of 15 to 25% of the low delta V asteroids are these carbonaceous types that are rich in water. So the Sutter telescope system that we hope to deploy in space for high-end asteroid prospecting is designed to tell us everything we need to know about an asteroid before we send a mining vehicle there to mine it. And what do we need to know about the asteroid? Well, first and foremost, we need to know its orbit. And we need to know its orbit to figure out how much rocket propellant it takes to get there, how much it takes to get back, what the trip time is there and back, and how much time we have for harvesting operations once we get to the asteroid. So we've actually run numerical simulations of thousands of synthetic asteroids. These are numerical models of asteroids to show that that business model closes. And we've actually published that paper in the open literature. Second thing we need to know is taxonomic type. Now, here we have a heterodox approach, heterodox meaning we have scientific justification for our approach, and we recognize that the mainstream science community has not yet come around to accepting this. One of the things that we'll do is once we get the trajectory of the asteroid, we will look at the asteroids with carefully selected filters that look at it in certain color bands. And these color bands will be selected not for scientific exploration, but for typing the asteroids with confidence that the types that hold the volatile materials that we're looking for. Now, there aren't telescopes operating with these spectral bands today because most of the filters on telescopes today were selected by astrophysicists or astronomers studying stars, and they were selected for the reasons of studying, you know, where stars are in the main sequence and that sort of thing. But we've looked at this spectral response of the asteroids, and what we've noticed is that there's a way, when you look statistically at them, to look in certain bands to rule out that they're not high in volatiles. Now, there's a disadvantage to this approach, and the disadvantage is there are many asteroids that are ambiguous that may be high in volatiles, but because they're ambiguous, they wouldn't be good mining targets until later in the industrial development. Also, there are some asteroid types that are high in water but can't be separated out using the observational technique that we plan, and so we won't be able to go after those initially. Okay, so number one, where is the asteroid? What is its orbit? Number two, is it of a type that we have high confidence that it's high in volatile? Number three, what is its size and rotation state? So there are various different ways of measuring the size of an asteroid, but basically what you do is you look at it in white light and in different spectral bands and in the infrared from different directions. And from this, you can get an idea of its infrared brightness. That gives you its albedo, knowing its absolute brightness, and gives you its size. And then the Sutter Ultra Telescope constellation is designed actually to view the asteroids simultaneously as they rotate from multiple directions in space. You can see an animation of how that works on our website. So this will give us the rotation state, the size, the taxonomic type, and the orbit. Once we have all those factors, then we'll know if the asteroid is a good candidate for economical harvesting. And we will expect these asteroids to come through an extended area around the Earth-Moon system at a certain frequency when we'll find them. And we'll have our mining vehicles parked in high orbit, ready to go after these missions, these mining missions of opportunity. And we know statistically how often that'll happen and how often we'll find them. So it's not like the way NASA does asteroid missions, which makes a lot of sense if you're NASA and you're taking this sort of very scientifically exquisite 20th century approach, where they study the asteroid for years in advance, plan the trajectories for years in advance, and then send a mission. Instead, we'll actually be doing observations, and within weeks of finding the asteroid, a pre-positioned asteroid mining vehicle, we call them honeybees, will change its trajectory to rendezvous with the asteroid. Once it gets to the asteroid, it'll enclose the asteroid in a bag after a process that we thought through very clearly technically, extract the water and other volatile materials from it, and then return that water and other volatile materials to cislunar space, where we can use the dirty water directly in our omnivore propulsion system, or we can process it, clean it up, and turn it into other propellants to sell to other consumers of propellants in cislunar space and Earth orbit.
I have another two-part question. It's a little bit on the long side. I'll see if I can shorten it and make it a little shorter. By the way, listeners, our phone line is available if you would like to call rather than email us, 1-866-687-7223. Again, it is available, and email remains available, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So this is a question from Shelley, and Shelley just says NYC, so I guess that's New York City. And Shelley says, I have a two-part question. The first part may be a little easier than the second part. There's a big concern and a big quest for humans to live in space, either on the surface of a planet or on an O'Neill type of platform where you can spin for 1G. I know determining the gravity prescription is a big deal. What does your company have in the way of services and products that can facilitate human space settlement, either on the surface of a planet or in free space? And are you doing anything on the gravity prescription side or any of the medical quandaries that affect humans in long-term space, or is that not part of your operandi for what you're doing to get us to be spacefaring? My second question is, you're talking about having tubs or honeybees or something that can be pre-positioned to move items and cargo, I guess not people, but maybe people down the road from one place in space to another. It's always been said that you need an enormous amount of energy to change orbits in space, that it's not really that easy to do, nor is it all that accurate. How are you planning to commercially and economically change orbits at will in space with different kinds of cargo? What kind of propulsion are these tugs using to enable them to do that? And is the fuel 100% space-made, or are you planning on nuclear fuel or something else? How is this challenge going to be conquered? So those are her questions.
Well, I think there's about 10 questions embedded in all of that. We could spend hours answering those questions. Let me try to do my best on it. And great question, Shelley. Thank you so much. First of all, I would invite you, in terms of the question of whether humans should settle other planetary surfaces or in free space, in settlements, in habitats built like the way Gerard O'Neill envisioned it in the 1970s and 80s. I'm a big believer in the thought that where most people should live in space in the distant future is clearly in free space settlements. That's the natural habitat for an intelligent species. And the reason is planets are very limited. We can build space habitats that have 1,000 times the carrying capacity of the Earth using the resources of just asteroids in the solar system. Whereas every time you go down to a planet, you're stuck on the surface of the planet, which is limited. And the only planet that humans are adapted for is the Earth. Now, it seems to me quite possible that humans would be fine living on lunar gravity or Martian gravity. But it's a big difference from saying it would probably be fine versus we know that it's fine. And right now what we know about biology is that there are very, very strong reasons to think that humans cannot adapt to reduced gravity or microgravity for multi-generational living. Sure, a highly trained and physically fit astronaut can live a few years in space. That's a very different thing from gestating children. And then now that we know in biology that the environment that you're in causes change in the markers on your DNA, in the methylation groups that can control gene expression, in the location of sirtuins that control gene expression, and that these markers are referred to as epigenetics that control gene expression, and they are inherited by your offspring. And so by exposing yourself to high radiation environments and to reduced gravity, we don't know what the long-term effects of those on large populations are. And we have very good reason to believe that they'll have permanent effects, multi-generational effects, as far as three generations out. So we could have a situation where each generation of people living in a non-terrestrial environment would have worse and worse biological outcomes to the point where they become non-viable and torturous for people. There's good reason to believe that that risk is real. There's also good reason to believe that it may not happen. But we can't ethically commit children from future generations to possible biological horrors without having good scientific reason to believe that it's safe. That would be a total violation of everything that we know about bioethics and good practices. However, we can build worlds in space that provide 1G of gravity and Earth normal radiation if we build them out of asteroid materials or maybe materials launched on electromagnetic launchers from the lunar. So I think you have to have a balanced perspective on this. And I'm a big advocate of doing the research now to find out what the optimal gravity level for humans is, and if in fact it's safe. So the way that I like to put it is before we settle the moon or Mars, we should have had 20 generations of mice raised at that gravity and radiation level, and 3 or 4 generations of dogs and rhesus monkeys. And then a few brave souls should try it, raising small families in a phase 1 trial. And once we've seen that children can grow up healthy in small and limited numbers, if in fact it works out fine, then we could consider settling planets. But until that happens, it would be an ethical nightmare. For more detail on that, I'd recommend that you go to my LinkedIn profile, Joel Sercell on LinkedIn, and there's a post on space ethics that I've pinned at the top of my profile.
So,
Transvestor is not working diligently on the problem of designing space habitats. We're working on sort of the things that have to be solved first. But we think the work that Gerard O'Neill did was solid, but it needs to be updated with modern manufacturing practices. Basically, how do you consume large quantities of materials in space with large machines and turn it into megastructures? We think that's actually very doable, and we need to get going on that, but we've got some more urgent problems to solve first. In terms of how we propose to get around in space, we think that The answer is the nuclear fusion reactor that lives at the center of our solar system. We call it the sun. The sun produces copious quantities of power, 1.4 gigawatts of raw solar thermal power for every square kilometer of space. That's a huge amount of space. That's a huge amount of power. And we think the right way to use it is with simple, lightweight, cost-effective solar concentrators that can concentrate that power down onto rocket engines and make solar-powered rocket engines that don't have to have costly, expensive, and slow electric propulsion systems. So we've patented, and we have more patents coming, our omnivore solar thermal rocket, and it can run on virtually any volatile fluid, including the fluids that we would harvest from asteroids. Go ahead, David.
Is this valid only for LEO and cislunar, or how far out from that would this kind of solar power be useful and powerful enough to work?
Yeah, sure. Solar thermal rockets are actually viable out to about the orbit of Jupiter. Solar intensity drops off as 1 over r squared as distance from the sun, but actually the sun's rays become more parallel as you move out into the deeper solar system, so you can get higher concentration ratios, which is a counterintuitive result. So it's not quite as bad as 1 over r squared. And we think that most of the industrial action and space settlements will be well inside the orbit of Mars for decades. So we think solar thermal propulsion is the best way to move cargo in space using in situ propellant feedstocks for decades to come.
Another question is from Alex, and he says he's in Memphis. And he says, down the road, not now, do you see commercial products being manufactured for sale either in space or back on Earth, assuming there are markets for it, both from free space stations where orbital manufacturing and industry might be trying to develop, certainly from the surface of the moon and maybe from the surface of Mars? Where do you see this kind of commerce coming from? Is it more likely from the moon, Mars, or a free station space vehicle? I'm not talking about tourism. I know that has commercial value. But what about industry? Where is its market going to come from? What are its products? Surely it has to have more than just rocket fuel.
Yeah, that's a great question. The first manufactured product that we'll have in space will be rocket propellant harvested from the moon and the asteroids. There are advantages and disadvantages to both. If you're on the moon, you should harvest your rocket propellant for returning from the moon, probably on the moon. If you're in free space, you should harvest your rocket propellant in free space from the nearest asteroids that have extremely low delta Vs that we've characterized. Once you're harvesting rocket propellant, it makes it much cheaper to get around in space. We anticipate the cost of in-space transportation with in-situ-derived propellants to be not that much more expensive than air travel. There are good physics and engineering reasons to believe this that we could go into. Once it becomes that cost-effective to get around in space, then you'll also start harvesting raw materials for simple things like radiation shielding. And after radiation shielding, it'll be simple things like structures that don't have to, that are very heavy and costly to launch up from the Earth, but they don't have to be as strong if they're made in space in a reduced gravity environment. Only later will fine manufacturing products be generated in space, initially for use in space and eventually for export down to the Earth. I could definitely envision a day in the future, whether it's distant or not too distant, I don't know, where you'll be driving an electric car where most of the structure and components in the electric car were made out of material harvested from an asteroid, fabricated in a robotic factory in space, and then dropped down to the Earth using reentry technology and big containers. And then the car could be finished and tuned, and you'd be driving around an asteroid-produced car. That is the vision that we should all be working for. Jeff Bezos had said that heavy industry should move to space, and that industry on the Earth should be light industry and services. And I agree with that. And when we do that, that will free the Earth's biosphere from the damage that's done by industrial activity on the Earth, and that's a good thing for everybody.
This is an unexpected question. At least it is for me. Harry's in Austin, Texas, and Harry says, David, I heard your recent coast-to-coast appearance with George, and toward the end of the show, you agreed, at least it sounded like you agreed, with a caller named Mary, who thought there might be a lot of unknowns by what we do with asteroids. She was particularly talking about the impact that happened a couple of weeks ago and wondered if perhaps we need to slow down in our development to think through all the possible consequences of our interference with various heavenly bodies and trying to move them or mine them or take resources from them. And you seem to suggest that maybe in some areas we need to give more thought to what we're doing because who knows what the impact might be. I'm wondering if you would say the same thing to Joel and his plans for asteroids. Are we certain, Joel, that there won't be any consequences or impact by what your plans are doing? Or might we need to take a step back and try to figure out the consequences of this type of activity before going forward with it?
Whenever anyone asks me a question, are you certain? The answer is no. Certainty is not something that humans experience in reality. And are there potential risks from the program that we would propose? Yes, we need to mitigate those risks. The key is not to drive the uncertainty to zero or to drive the risk to zero. It's to make sure that we're doing it, that we're aware of the risk, that the risks are acceptable, and that we're approaching risk management in a proper ethical and moral way. Two gentlemen who I knew back in the 20th century, Carl Sagan and Steve Ostro, collaborated on a paper. This was before they both passed away too early, on asteroid mining, and said we should not develop the technology to mine asteroids. And the reason being that anyone who has the technology to mine and harvest asteroids would have the technology to turn them into weapons and drop them on cities. And it's a sobering thought, and it's a thought that's been played out in science fiction. Likewise, you know, the Expanse had the Belters, who were the asteroid miners, destroying the terrestrial environment by dropping thousands of asteroids on the Earth. The classic science fiction story, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, points out that if you have electromagnetic launch for harvesting resources off the Moon, you can use that to bombard the Earth. My biggest concern would be about malfeasance with humans. The chances that you would accidentally cause an asteroid to hit the Earth are astronomically small, but they should be taken seriously. The chances that a crazy person would intentionally redirect an asteroid to hit the Earth, that's not a joke and needs to be taken very seriously. So I think we need to be careful about these things, and I think these risks are manageable, but let's be responsible with what we do.
I know we're near the end of a 90-minute space shuttle program, but you have mentioned sustainability and ethics and being moral. So sometimes all of this is subjective, as you well know. But there are guidelines out there from various sources. Do you have like a creed or a code, or what do you do to assure ethics and sustainability and moral decision making from your perspective? How do you build that in to running a business?
You make it part and parcel of what you do every day. You think about it, you talk about it, you act on it. Businesses are motivated in order to, it's hard to keep a business in business. You know, if you look at the life cycle of businesses, almost all of them go out of business eventually. And so, and businesses have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to make profit, and they have a moral and ethical responsibility to their employees to employ them, to keep them employed. And that drives businesses sometimes to cut corners on ethics and gets people in trouble. That's why we have boards of directors. That's why we have government regulation. At the larger societal level, it's very important to have the right level of regulation. You know, the people on the political extremes, there's one political extreme that thinks all corporations are evil and there's never enough regulation. And on the other extreme, I think that that corporations should not be regulated. You know, sort of the libertarian extreme. I fall somewhere in between. And I think regulation should be based on proper ethical frameworks and should be moderate but sufficient. And maybe err a little bit on the under-regulated side until problems happen. The issue here, if folks go to the essay that General Steve Quast and I wrote on my LinkedIn profile. The issue here is that every time humanity moves into a new domain, whether it's a new physical space or a new technological space like the internet or atomic power, automobiles, they apply the ethics, morality, standards, laws, and regulations of where they've been, and it never quite works. And then there are big problems that occur. As a result of those problems, people get new insights into the proper ethical behaviors. That results in new regulation, and things settle down, and it works out okay in the long run. The problem is, as we get into many more, much more powerful technologies, and here I'm referring primarily to three things. Biotech, AI, and space. The consequences of making mistakes in these areas are existential to our species. And so we need to think in advance about the problem rather than reacting retroactively the way we have historically. That's why we wrote that essay. I think Transastra is still a small, young company. We're working on the ground. We're going to be in space soon. What we're doing doesn't break any new ethical frontiers yet, but it will. And that's why we're thinking about it. As we start to break into new frontiers, then we need a structured approach to this problem. We begin by thinking about it, getting good and like-minded people involved in the process. And then we think, what are the light regulations and laws that we need to put in place to make sure that things are done responsibly? The other thing we need to realize is all countries are not created equal. Although the United States is imperfect, it does have, in my opinion, the greatest record of human rights and good of any other country. And it's highly flawed, but humanity is flawed. On the other hand, historically, the United States did some things that were imperialistic and so on. It's not doing those today. But there are countries like Russia and China that are currently imperialistic, currently engaged in cultural genocide. These countries are space powers, and they will take their activities into space just as they are. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a huge advocate for the Space Force and making sure that free markets, human rights, care for the environment, and the rule of law are brought into space. If entrepreneurs can't benefit from their hard work in space, We won't settle the solar system. And the only way that's going to happen is if markets are protected and the rule of law extends into space. That's what the mission of the Space Force ought to be, and I think the Space Force understands that.
In your knowing other space businesses around the country doing all sorts of different things, there's more forming every day, it seems, because I get their PR announcements wanting to be on the space show. Do you think there's commonality in this emerging, developing industry on ethics, on the consequences, on not erring, on a balance in regulations, the things that you have espoused belief in and followance to? Do you think that's industry-wide, or are there gaps and problems within the industry?
It's not. There are some folks who are brilliant and well-respected, deservedly, who are really advocating for just going forward, damn the torpedoes. I consider Robert Zubrin to be a friend, and I respect his technical expertise deeply. But when he makes statements about, well, we should go ahead and settle Mars, and if there's life on Mars and it's just some algae or something, who cares? We're putting algae ahead of human beings. Without poo-poos the possible multi-generational biological effects, you know, that will be fine. People are over-exaggerating the problems with gravity and radiation. So he and I have he's a real leader in the field. Elon Musk doesn't talk a lot about this, but I get the impression that he's more closely aligned with Robert Zubrin. Elon Musk is maybe the greatest engineer that ever lived and a brilliant businessman. But when it comes to things outside of the domain of business and engineering, you know, if he's really seriously talking about building huge settlements on Mars, which is what he says, without first doing the biological research to make sure that it's safe and it doesn't cause horrible deformation, you know, horrible birth defects three generations in, then that would be irresponsible if he said that. So I think there are some people who are, I mean, I'm a huge advocate of space settlement. I'm a huge advocate of building not settlements, but outposts in space. Where we do the work, we don't raise children in space until we know that it's reasonably safe. We start in small numbers, as I said. 20 generations of mice, 3 or 4 generations of the dogs and rhesus monkeys, and phase 1 trials of small families before we consider massive settlements. But we can have massive outposts where scientists, engineers, and tourists go there for days, weeks, months, even years, and soon children, but that's a big difference from settlement.
Do you have any, if you don't want to answer this, that's fine, but is this like a mandate for people you hire that they have to sign on to an ethical or a moral policy? So is there a policy, an employment policy? Is it codified or written down any place in your company?
Well, like most companies, we have an employee handbook that provides guidelines on proper ethical behaviors within the company. It doesn't go into these issues of, you know, what's the right thing to do with regard to settling Mars, the moon, or free space.
There are companies out there working on orbital construction, so orbital assembly comes to mind. Do you think we're prepared for orbital construction on a large scale, and we know best where to locate such construction in space, or is that something that needs a lot more thought to it?
Well, whenever someone says, does it need a lot more thought, the answer is yes. And that's typically not a reason to slow down. And are we prepared? The answer is almost never yes, and that's okay. if we think it through carefully enough that we know everything in advance before we move, that's too slow. I think ultimately questions like where should we build factories in space will be answered by market. If someone builds a factory in space in the wrong place, they won't be as competitive as the person who built it in the right place. Now, if someone wants to build a million-ton factory in low Earth orbit, there's safety issues associated with that, involving orbital debris, deorbiting, impacting the planet, that sort of thing. Those things need to be dealt with. But I don't think we're at the point where anything like that is happening. So I think in terms of optimizing our approaches here, each entrepreneur or government agency will do its best to optimize its approach. The market will tell who won, who got it right. But I would say that we should think through the basic tenets of space ethics, bioethics, human rights, stewardship, and we should apply those to what we do in space and think about where do we need to make sure things are properly regulated. I would say that current protocols for in space have already shown that we're blowing it on the stewardship issue. The orbital debris environment is becoming somewhat untenable. Today, if you're in a lightweight spacecraft akin to a space capsule, like some companies are building, and you're transiting to something like the space station that has bumper shielding against debris, probably your greatest risk of dying on that mission is during the transit to the space station, and it's from debris. The space shuttle was nearly taken out by debris a few times. The orbital debris environment is a result of irresponsible treatment of low Earth orbit and the protocols that we've had in place for decades. For example, there's no salvage rights in space, like there are salvage rights on the sea. So people can do things like leave derelict rocket bodies, derelict spacecraft floating around, and if someone touches them from another country, it's considered to be something like an act of war. That's just not right. People should be empowered to clean up the mess in space, and if someone leaves derelict materials around, someone else should be allowed to profit from that with salvage rights. So we've messed up a little bit already, but it's not too late to get it right.
Before we go, you went into a partnership with this telescope that anybody can get time on, SLU. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, we're very excited about that. So SLU is a wonderful company that is in the education space. And they operate telescopes all over the world at different locations, and they're building new observatories in new locations. And amateurs, many people in your audience, educators and students, can go log on to their system and control the SLU telescopes, look at the sky, take pictures, that sort of thing. Teachers can get lesson plans, give their students, and the students can go in and do observations from these telescopes to learn about space. And it's a wonderful company. And so TransAster has a partnership with them to build our Sutter telescopes on the ground at their observatories, and also to collaborate with them to build a space telescope that educators and students will be able to control for doing astronomical observation. And then we will also use the imagery from those space telescopes for prospecting asteroids and commercial space domain awareness. So it's a win-win for everyone.
And
this is a great way to democratize them.
Is the work with SLU starting up yet? Because this is a fairly new agreement, right?
Yeah, it's a new agreement. We're doing the planning work with them right now, and there's no coincidence that we have this agreement with Celestron. You'll see how a lot of these things come together in the coming weeks. By the way, we also have partnerships with other companies, including big aerospace companies and so on. And so when you listed your advertisers, we actually have partnerships with some of your advertisers, which I'm not going to talk about.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. Where would those big companies be without the entrepreneurial commercial space industry, which has been emerging over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Because if you look at Boeing trying to develop their capsule, and look at SpaceX, what a difference. So not to take away from Boeing, but they haven't even launched it yet. So
So I think the smart leaders of big aerospace companies and have realized that the paradigm of systems engineering and project management came down after World War II in the 20th century. Is just not effective for developing complex engineering systems. And instead, you need to, like no effective company in the space business should have a systems engineering department. Systems engineering should be owned by the engineers who are building things. And it's really, it's not systems engineering in the 20th century sense, it's system engineering. We're going to engineer the system. And we're going to manage and coordinate. And modern information systems and modern collaboration tools just make all of those old processes obsolete. And you can be easily 20 times more effective if you throw a lot of that stuff away. Now, it's good to be an expert on it when you throw it away, so that you know the potential benefits of those things, and you put in processes that work using modern processes. So, don't be cavalier in throwing it away if you don't understand what you're throwing away. Be careful. So TransAstra uses modern agile engineering and collaboration methods to do our systems engineering. Everyone at TransAstra is a systems engineer, but we certainly don't have a systems engineering department.
Have we omitted or forgotten something, or is there something additional you would like to talk about before we sign off?
Well, I just want to make it clear that our commercial line that lead to our vision are Sutter Telescope technology for space domain awareness and asteroid prospecting, our omnivore rocket propulsion systems, which are 10 times faster than electric propulsion and a fraction of the cost of electric or chemical propulsion because they don't involve toxic chemicals or explosives or big solar arrays. And with the omnivore propulsion system, that enables our Worker Bee orbit transfer vehicles to be the ultimate orbital logistics vehicle. It can run on water, ethanol, or many other fluids. Those will be operating in low Earth orbit soon, and later they'll provide the foundation for our Honeybee line of robotic asteroid missions. And so all the technologies that we have at TransAstra apply to our vision, but they also all have near-term commercial potential to do things like orbital debris cleanup, satellite delivery, and space domain awareness.
Terrific. Well, we will continue to follow what you're doing and look forward to talking to you again down the road. And thank you very much for coming back on the Space Show and giving us some updates and sharing your ideas and thoughts about important contemporary issues for space and actually for terrestrial business as well. It's good to hear from you again. Thank you very much, Joel.
It's wonderful, David. Great to hear from you also. Thank you.
Okay. Listeners, that's it for today. On Sunday, Frank Slazer of the Coalition for Deep Space Exploration is with us. That show is going to start 30 minutes late. It will start at 12:30 p.m. Pacific time, not noon. So make sure you note the change for that. And the following week, the only show that will take place will be on Friday and Sunday. And that's because I'm back to getting some of the additional dental work needed that has plagued me over the last couple of years, given that unfortunate dog attack story that you all have probably heard way too much about. So we'll leave it at that. Joel is off the line, but on behalf of Joel, and all of you who emailed us today, thank you very much. Goodbye from Joel, David, and The Space Show. We will be back Sunday, remember, 12:30 p.m. Pacific time, not noon. Everybody keep looking up. Have a good weekend coming up.